Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We all know what fast food is and what's good and bad about it. But I wonder how many of my listeners out there have heard the term slow food and know about the slow food movement. I mean, I've heard about it, but I don't really know much about it. I don't think it's just the opposite of fast food. I don't think it means just good old-fashioned home-cooked meals. I think there's a lot more to it. And it's also kind of connected, I think, to a growing trend in top restaurants around the country to use farm-fresh, locally grown ingredients rather than processed or frozen food. So that's what we want to talk about today on American Variety, and I have two guests with me. One is Melinda Himmelgarn, who's a registered dietitian in Missouri. She's a columnist and a speaker and writer on food topics and, in general, a food expert. She also has a radio show called The Food Sleuth. So in all those media, she tells me she connects the dots between food, health, and agriculture to find food truth. And my other guest is Tyler Brown. He's the highly regarded executive chef of the Capital Grill restaurant at the famous Hermitage Hotel in Nashville, Tennessee. And I gather in 2011, Esquire magazine named Tyler one of the four new chefs to watch. And Gourmet magazine has called the Capital Grill one of America's best restaurants. So since 2010, Tyler's been growing much of his restaurant's food on a large historic estate in Nashville and experimenting with heirloom vegetables. So they're both kind of involved in this concept of slow food and farm-to-table movement from the standpoint of, a policy person and an expert on it, and then also from a producer and user standpoint. So we're going to talk with both of them about those two aspects and those two movements in American cuisine and culture. So first, Melinda, to start with you, what is the slow food movement? Is it basically just the opposite of fast food, or is it something else?
Well, that's a really good way to describe it, actually. It was formed in 1986 as the result of a McDonald's trying to establish itself in Rome. So it was started by a gentleman by the name of Carlo Petrini. And slow food truly is the antithesis of fast food. It tries to preserve the cultural heritage of our food systems. It tries to create a culture where we regard our food with gratitude and respect. It is a kind of thinking where we have relationships around our food. It would be exactly what Tyler is doing at his restaurant, where he's producing his own food, he's paying attention to heirloom crops, he's bringing that good fresh food to the table, and he is paying close attention, I'm sure, to how it's prepared. But in a nutshell, slow food is good, clean, fair food.
Does it also mean organic? I mean, we're also used to the use and abuse of that term in everything we buy in the grocery store nowadays. Is it a lot related to organic gardening and vegetables?
Well, organic food could certainly be a part of slow food because organic food is raised with respect to the soil and the environment. I think the abuse that we see is more with other labels, such as natural. The natural label is highly abused in the marketplace. But the slow food movement does not require that food is raised in an organic fashion, although simply by definition to say that food is clean means that it really does adhere to many of the organic principles.
Yeah, I would think so. So I think you also use the term fair food, not just F-A-R like table fare, but F-A-I-R. What does that mean?
Well, that implies an element of social justice. So for example, and I'll tell you a story that Carlo Petrini told at a Kellogg conference where I attended. He said he was in California. He was prepared this delicious meal. It was organic. It was prepared on this beautiful setting in a vineyard. He said, but you know, the workers were treated like slaves. And he said, that is not good food. So the workers need to be paid a living wage. They should be able to afford the food they're growing, and they should be able to afford to feed their families. And likewise, the animals that are raised should be respected for giving the ultimate sacrifice. So the animals are treated kindly and fairly as well.
Okay, so I see. There's a, let's call it a social and even political dimension to it, but it's not the core of the slow food part itself.
The food has to taste good.
Yeah.
Okay, it has to be good for us. It needs to be clean, so there's this environmental component that we don't want to harm our environment in the way in which we raise our food. And the fairness or the justice component is very much a part of the definition of slow food. So they're all three extremely important.
Okay, gotcha. Well, you mentioned one person and how this slow food movement started as kind of a reaction to the introduction of a McDonald's in Rome. But does it have leaders or main proponents, or is it just kind of grassroots?
The headquarters are based in Brooklyn, New York. That's Slow Food USA.
Okay.
But there's also a global slow food presence. In fact, they have an annual meeting in Italy every year. And it is absolutely part of a global movement because there is so much to lose with regard to our culture and the quality of our food. So Slow Food has about 225 chapters within the United States. We have one here in Columbia, Missouri. And we get together and we have anything from, you know, white tablecloth dinners on farms to potluck dinners together where we celebrate our food and the gathering of people and the relationships that come with that.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Melinda Himmelgarn and Tyler Brown about the slow food movement and the farm-to-table movement, two kind of trends in food preparation and production and presentation, let's say, in American culture today. So, Chef Tyler, how long has the Hermitage Hotel been around?
The Hermitage Hotel has opened in 1910.
Wow.
So we just celebrated our 100-year anniversary in 2010 and started working in 2010 on our farm at Glen Levin as well, and kind of what we've been doing with our farm-to-table movement here at the hotel.
So the Hermitage Hotel has a lot of heritage, too, being over a century old. I assume the cuisine in the restaurant had always been traditional Southern food. How would you characterize it now?
I think one thing that we really focus on is our cultural sustainability. We really try to tell a story with what we do here at the hotel through our food, through what we do with our community and our farming. Now moving into recently just purchased another farm, and we're raising our own beef there, and our hopes are to provide all of our own beef, but also sell it to local restaurants in the community as well.
Wow. Big change. When did you take over the kitchen?
I took over the kitchen in 2006. I've been here at the hotel since 2003, but in 2006, I took over as executive chef.
So did you come in with these new ideas, or has your style of cooking kind of evolved during the several years you've been there now?
I would say it's certainly an evolution. I think through working hard with local producers in our community and building relationships with them, becoming more aware of, you know, again, to talk about the cultural sustainability and the historical relevance, you know, that's something that I've been very passionate about, things that are staples in our culture and highlighting them on our menu and what we do every day at the hotel, and really trying to tell that story about what used to happen around the table with grandmothers, you know, what our favorite things were around the table. I think that's something that's really lost in our culture is the act of breaking bread and sitting down and that opportunity of checks and balances around the table. And so trying to create a little spark around the table and give people things to talk about, reflect on, and to resonate with folks when they have the opportunity to dine with us.
So I think to me that's what distinguishes a chef from a cook. It's somebody who has like a big vision of what they do and kind of a creative professional approach to it, where they're aware of the history and the culture of what they're doing, and they kind of push the envelope in little ways, you know, or they personalize it in various ways, or they kind of adapt it to the locality of where they are. And it seems like that's what you're doing. So you mentioned a while ago the Glen Levin farm, and our listeners don't know about that, but I think you got access to this big farm where you can grow your own stuff. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, Glen Levin farm is a Revolutionary War land tract that is 4 miles from our hotel here. We've had the opportunity to work with the Land Trust for Tennessee and create a partnership where we have the opportunity to farm the land. We started doing that in 2010. And the idea was just to get the community more involved, have the opportunity to grow a garden. For myself, I had never grown any vegetables aside from 2 tomato plants the year before, and was really interested in, again, building the relationships with local farmers and producers, and wanted to sort of try our hand at it, and had the opportunity again with the relationship with the Land Trust. And so the idea was to create a period sustainable garden utilizing biodynamics, focusing on our soil composition, and really telling the story through heirloom seeds and sourcing, you know, as many things that we can around here in respects of, again, the heirloom seeds and things that told a story, just getting them out there in the field. And it proves to be a very steep learning curve.
Yeah, I would say you made a huge jump from a guy who had grown two whole tomato plants to doing that kind of thing with heirloom vegetables and all that. In case people don't know what heirloom seeds and heirloom plants are, what's that in a nutshell, so to speak?
Well, a real basic thing would be seeds and things that haven't been genetically modified and that are oftentimes they have a lower yield in respects of production, but to me tend to be the most tasty things, and they have that little extra luster because of the story that they have behind them. And that's what really separates what we do and what's important to us here at the hotel. They're not necessarily grown on a large level or produced in masses anymore, although they are coming back around. You know, things like one thing I'm very passionate about are different types of field peas. So like a louder milk butter bean or a purple hull pea or a Cherokee purple tomato or a garden peach tomato.
So there, a lot of them are things that are that were used 100 years ago and are not have not been hybridized into some perfect version of what was originally around in pioneer times, right? So they're kind of pioneer fruits and vegetables, a lot of them.
Correct.
You know, so on this place, the Glenlevin Farm is itself kind of a pioneer establishment, an old plantation. And so had it been farmed in recent years? And then how do you plant and harvest your crops? How do you do what you do?
So it probably been over 50 years, I think, since it's been in the same family since the Revolutionary War, the piece of property up until 2006. And we feel that it's probably about 50 years since it had actually been cultivated and farmed. And so a long time it's been laying fallow. Mm. So in 2010, just took a shot in the dark on, you know, I was like, hey, it would be really neat to plant a garden out there. And luckily was given the opportunity to do that. And so I really had to start from the ground floor up and go out and buy some tractors and all the equipment that goes into that and source the seeds. And, you know, that's been an amazing experience meeting all of different people and that I've come in contact with sourcing the different seeds and all the different stories and, you know, getting out there and getting them in the ground and understanding how to go about that. So there's been a lot of mistakes. I remember our first season, we had planted the garden and it was early June and things started coming up and I started to get very intimidated and was realizing, man, I don't know when to harvest all this stuff. I don't know what the story is here. And so I went and asked a farmer friend of mine, you know, so when do I start harvesting? How do I know when things are ready? And he said to me, he goes, you know, Tyler, my father said to me one time, the best fertilizer is a farmer's footsteps.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, note taken. I'll be here at 5 a.m. tomorrow morning, you know, and just spending more time out there, being more aware of observation and the ongoings with the plants. And you'll know when the time is right. And so it's really just spending the time out there and absorbing yourself with everything that's going on and observation and making mistakes. And a lot of times we harvest things when they weren't ready. And, you know, that's just a learning thing. You know, also a huge part of that has been the Mother Nature aspect of, you know, as a chef, we can control many things within the four walls of the kitchen, and transferring that over into agriculture and growing, you realize very quickly that you're not in control of anything. And you really have to operate within the confines that Mother Nature allows us to, which has been a great experience.
Yeah. So it sounds like obviously you don't do this yourself. Have you enlisted a whole team of staff who've become farmers along with you?
No, I do most of it myself with the help of our staff in the kitchen and then a number of volunteers and a couple other folks. So it takes a number of people to make it happen, but it's most of the labor, I would say, were a core of about 3 to 4 people.
Yeah, there you go. So would you say you're now kind of all in with the farm-to-table approach to restaurant cooking?
Oh, absolutely. You know, with the recent purchase of this new 250-acre farm and our hopes to grow our herd of cattle in the next number of years to 100 head and to really start producing, providing all of our own beef and, again, to local restaurants. And then with the already aspect of growing our own vegetables and doing that is, I would say that we were all in.
Wow. So you're becoming a regional provider even. So what are the, you know, from a chef's perspective, what are the advantages of doing this? Obviously, the stuff tastes better and you get more variety, but what else?
Well, I mean, the education, the perspective, the respect that one gains for understanding what it really takes to produce all of these items. And then, you know, from on the animal standpoint, the respect you have for the sacrifice of the animal's life and what they are giving to us to have the opportunity to eat that, you know, and you just gain a lot more respect for the whole process. And it makes you appreciate what you have and what you're putting in front of your customers on a daily basis. And the customers love to hear the story and really enjoy and feel that they taste the difference, which I certainly do as well. You know, if I didn't feel that there was some credence to what we were doing, we wouldn't spend the time to do that. You know, really something that we believe in and that we've bought into wholeheartedly and really feel comfortable moving forward in this direction.
So it really does overlap with what Melinda was calling good, clean, fair food. And obviously it's good, but you're describing how it's clean too. There's no pesticides in it and that kind of thing. And then it's fair because you're your own labor force. You're not abusing your your life by doing it. You're doing what you want to do. So that's good. I'll tell you what, you know, you've talked about the advantages of doing it, but what are some of the disadvantages? I mean, you mentioned the weather, but are things seasonal where you'd like to get something, but you just can't? You have to wait 3 months, or do you have limited choices? And how about insects and all those things?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, the weather plays a huge part in all of those things you just mentioned, you know, with the amount of insects, the moisture, whether we're having a drought. This was our third season. We're just wrapping up here, planting season, growing season. And up until about August, we haven't irrigated at all. We really rely, again, on our biodynamics and our soil composition and our composting and adding all the elements that we can to the soil to sustain those vegetables and those plants. And something that I also feel is when you overwater or water too much, plants become greedy and they become dependent on that water. And so we had really worked on not doing that, although this year, the end of June, started to experience a very serious drought for the second year in a row. And, you know, had to learn that, hey, if we're not willing to water, we're not willing to have any vegetables. So we started to use a drip tape irrigation just to get the seeds germinated and up. And really, it's proved to be a beneficial thing for us. And it's one of those things you have to adapt and sometimes step outside of your ideals to ultimately succeed.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, in the end, you are running a restaurant, and you've got to put food on the table one way or the other, so you have to do what you have to do, but you're trying to do it as conscientiously as you can.
Certainly.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Chef Tyler Brown from the Capitol Grill restaurant at the famous Hermitage Hotel in Nashville, and we also have on the line Melinda Himmelgarn, who is a dietitian in Missouri who's an expert on food and has a show called The Food Sleuth, and at the end of the show, we're going to give you directions to get to both of their sites and see what they do in more detail. But Melinda, what Chef is talking about sounds like a great example of farm to table. So what do you think?
I think I need to make a road trip and make a reservation.
Good
point. I love what you're doing, Tyler. It's a beautiful celebration of food.
Where in the country is this whole thing taking hold? Is it just some places more, or is it kind of moving across? Obviously, Tyler's in the Midwest or, you know, on the edge of it or whatever. Are there areas where it hasn't gotten started? What's the geography of it so far, Melinda?
Well, sure. I mean, there are places where you've got wonderful access to good food. And then there are places where we call them food deserts, or they, you know, if you can imagine an area where you're driving down the road and you get hungry and the only thing available is a Casey's rest stop or a McDonald's. And unfortunately, there are too many pockets of our nation like that. And there are many reasons for that. I mean, we've had a lot of consolidation within our food industry. For example, as Tyler was talking, I was thinking, oh, this is great. He's going to be growing or raising his own beef. And my first question was, he's going to need a slaughter facility. And when I speak to farmers and consumers and schools and institutions, there are certain barriers that rear their ugly heads. And one is access to a slaughtering plant. One is access to, you know, another one is access to markets. the beauty of the farm to institution, and we see this going on around the country. There are some great examples, even with hospitals. So it's happening with restaurants, it's happening with hospitals, it's also happening with schools, and you're going to start seeing more farms associated with grocery stores as well.
Hmm.
And it's a great way to, as Tyler was describing, you know, have that relationship piece and that story. That's how we learn, is through stories, and it's a very powerful way to connect with people. And we human beings, if I've learned anything in my 30-year career as being a dietitian, is that we are hungriest for relationships. And so when food meets that need, it's a beautiful thing.
I lived for a number of years in the Washington, D.C. area in Northern Virginia, and there was a fresh market nearby. It was the first time I'd ever heard of a fresh market, and I think, you know, possibly it may have been the first one even. And they would do something that was radical at the time. We're talking about the early to mid-80s. We're not too far there from the eastern shore of Maryland, and so in, let's say, late July, August timeframe, they would start to bring things in from that breadbasket over there on the eastern shore, particularly corn and so on, and they would actually bring a truck into the back of the store and then bring wheelbarrows in and pile up huge piles of corn that were still hot from the fields. And, you know, so you're talking about all these relatively affluent suburbanites and D.C. people would find out from the store when that was going to be. And you would see dozens of people standing around in suits and briefcases trying to get a pile of fresh tomatoes or corn or whatever it would be from the farm at that time. So there's really a hunger for that kind of thing. And I was going to ask you, what are the health and nutrition aspects of this movement then, Melinda?
Well, the beauty of it is, you know, the best tasting food comes when the time frame between farm and table is short. Heat, light, and oxygen are the three big nutrient and flavor destroyers. That's not to say that you can't harvest green beans from your garden and cook them to death on your stove. I mean, you can destroy good food.
Sure.
And it takes a talented chef like Tyler to make that food taste really good. But when you start out with a less than ideal ingredient, there really isn't much you can do to make it taste great other than adding perhaps a lot of, you know, flavor enhancements, maybe MSG, salt, sugar, but you're not getting the true delicious taste of that food. So the fresher, the better, with regard to both nutrition and taste. And really, I mean, I think that getting back to that slow food definition, part of the definition of good food is that it's got to taste good.
Yeah, that's for sure. So what about the chemicals part of it? You don't taste that necessarily when you're eating more processed food that's been shipped from some other continent, but it's there.
Even California. I mean, here we are, you know, we're based largely, you know, on this side of the Rocky Mountains, the east side of the Rocky Mountains. And so you're looking at food that is traveling a long distance. And so during that, maybe the food is harvested before it's exactly ripe, but
right.
It's ripened en route.
Mm.
Foods that are produced for long distance travel are not your heirloom varieties because they tend to be more susceptible to damage. They're very... you know, they're designed to be eaten when they're ripe, not shipped for hundreds of miles.
Mm-hmm.
And so the quality of the food that we produce, say, on a farm like Tyler's, is far superior in taste. And if you were to stick that same great-tasting food on a truck and carry it across the country, maybe 2, 3, 4 days, and then you've got wait time before you have it, before you serve it, all of that time, the flavor is deteriorating as well as the nutritional content. And this is true even if you have a home garden and you harvest spinach. You know, if you let it sit in your crisper for a week, you're not going to get the same nutritional and taste qualities either.
Sure.
So another really interesting thing is that with the industrialization of our food system, crops that are produced for that they're bred to be larger. Right? We talked a little bit about heirloom varieties versus, say, the hybridized or the genetically modified crops.
Mm.
So they're genetically modified crops are genetically modified largely to withstand spraying of herbicides. Many consumers don't understand that. And then the hybridized crops, you can, you know, breed for certain traits. That's more traditional breeding. But when you start breeding crops for size, you tend to dilute the nutritional quality and the flavor.
Yeah, there's no question that a vine-ripened tomato tastes like a totally different vegetable than one of those semi-red, semi-orange things that's perfectly round and clean without any blotches or spots on it that you get in a grocery store. And you can get good tomatoes in a grocery store, but the standard tomato in the big bin is a totally different thing. So, Melinda, are slow food and farm-to-table approaches more sustainable, we hear that word a lot, than mass-market food production?
Well, you have to be careful with the word sustainable. In an ideal world, it would basically be a three-legged stool. Think of that, where one leg is environmentally sound production, the second leg is economically viable production, and the third is socially just. So again, those three components that we heard about slow food, that is the definition of sustainability that I like to use. But it's not a legal definition. So anybody and their brother can put, you know, oh yeah, we're sustainable. The folks that make genetically modified food will tell you that they're sustainable. They're not by the tried and true definition of sustainability.
Hmm.
But I'll tell you a little story. I was in Washington, D.C. a couple of summers ago, and I went to the farmer's market at the Foggy Bottom Metro stop. And there was a table of peaches. These were the first of the season. So you know what that's like. Your mouth starts watering as soon as you see them. And I went up to him and I said, oh, are these organically grown? And he said, no, ma'am, we raise our food sustainably. So I thought, what does that mean? So I asked. And he started to describe the fungicides and herbicides that he sprayed on his fruit. And I thought, thanks, but no thanks. And I think that something that Tyler mentioned I wanted to get back to, and that is that people are really culturalized or trained to think that the perfect-looking fruit or vegetable is the best. And that leads farmers to want to use many of these chemicals that protect the crop from disease. And we don't want crops to be diseased, but there are wonderful methods that organic farmers use to keep their crops resilient and protect them against invaders. Biodiversity, for example, is a huge method. But we need to rethink even when we eat a tomato. If this is January, tomatoes aren't in season here, and we need to wait and have that level of anticipation that comes in July when those tomatoes are ripe.
Melinda, we've got just less than a minute left, I think, but just very briefly, what do you think is the outlook for this type of food provision? Will it continue to spread and grow rapidly or slowly? What do you think, just real briefly?
It has to, because the industrialized food system that we have right now is not sustainable.
I want to give ways to get to more information from both our guests. Melinda's Food Sleuth blog is at food-sleuth, sleuth.blogspot.com. And there you can find a link to podcasts that are on a radio station, kopn.org, and listen to a lot of other shows. And then you can go also to the Capital Grill Nashville, Capital, that's C-A-P-I-T-O-L, Grill, with two L's in the middle, Nashville.com, CapitalGrillNashville.com, to see Tyler Brown's restaurant and everything they do there, and has photos and so on of the farm he was talking about. I want to thank both of you for being on with us. It's been a fascinating show.
Well, thank you, and Tyler, for what you're doing.
Yeah, thanks again to both of you. And I look forward also
to having you guys down sometime.
Yeah, I look forward also to coming over to Nashville to the restaurant, Tyler, I'm sure. Maybe Melinda and I'll make a date and get over there.
Let's do.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.